This is the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. Our leader at the moment is Thomas Cahill, who is taking us through the mysteries of the Middle Ages and the beginning of the modern world. And that connection is what you have looked for in this whole series you call The Hinges of History. You had taken us through women coming to a place of their own, if you will, or at least a greater, more serious role. The arts and the sciences, these are the giants. I'll probably scramble this and say, Isaac Newton said that he did his important work standing on the shoulders of giants. You're talking about the shoulders of giants whom then the Renaissance is going to stand. But you're talking about all of those folks who are getting us ready for a major change in the human experience in the West.
Yes, yes. And what we think of as connected with the Renaissance really gets started in the 12th and 13th centuries.
That would be the 1100s and the 1200s.
Right, and you have real science going on at places, especially Oxford. Oxford is one of the early hotbeds of real science. And Roger Bacon is the figure that I use.
And there are others.
There are plenty of others, and I name them toward the end of the chapter, or at least some of them. But he's such an interesting figure, I think. He's hard to pin down. Most of these other people, we know what they look like. We have no idea what Roger looked like, and I don't think he ever stayed still long enough for anybody to find out. You know, he in his own lifetime he created about 2.5 dictionaries. To write a dictionary all by yourself is a lifetime experience. You know, it will. For most people, but he managed to. When he died, he was working on an Arabic dictionary, and he was well on his way.
And that's the little thing he did.
Yeah, exactly. It's the thing he's least remembered for.
And we are still influenced by Roger Bacon in all sorts of interesting ways.
Yeah, he is an experimenter. He is one of the early people, not alone, there were plenty of others who were saying the same sort of thing, saying, well, theory's very nice, but let's see if we can make it work. See if our eyes can tell us that this is working.
And our senses, our eyes and everything else.
Yeah, our eyes and our other senses.
And, right. In that context, you do as good a job as I've seen of laying out the predicates of the transition from a Platonic worldview to an Aristotelian worldview, and it underlies all of this. It's in the arts, it's in the spiritual, the religious, and certainly in the science. It's in the entire intellectual and in many ways emotional part of this transition. But I don't think most of us think about Aristotle and Plato,
or how much they are with us.
Particularly at this hinge, as you characterize it, that's medieval. We're talking about people that are long dead, 1,000+ years, millennia plus past, and all of a sudden, the relationship between them becomes very important.
Well, for the Greeks, Plato was the great philosopher. And he really created an enormous division between the world of spirit and the world of flesh. And
may I just plug in, Socrates is in there too. We always say Plato, but Plato is bringing Socrates to the fore.
Except Socrates wasn't Plato.
We don't know, because Socrates didn't write anything down.
And Plato did.
So we don't know whether Plato is actually depending on Socrates or using Socrates as a literary figure to expound his own thoughts. That's
thank you.
The problem
with
there.
A bow to Socrates.
Right.
Thank you. So Plato is the big guy in
well,
the
certainly
Greeks.
For the Greeks. And but Plato really, in the myth of the cave, most people are sitting in the dark. They are looking at shadows on the wall. They don't know what makes the shadows
on
the wall.
They're chained to the cave's wall.
Yeah, because they're chained to their physical life, and they cannot get out of there, and they cannot reach the outside, the world of the sunlight.
Pretty dreary.
It's very harsh stuff, but it also took a very dim view of the human mind. Most human minds. Plato thought his mind was fine, but most of us were sitting in the cave in the dark. To which his best pupil, Aristotle, said, "Oh, nonsense. What we see is what's there. Our senses actually tell us, by and large, we can be fooled, yes, but by and large, our senses actually tell us what's there. We are not in the shadows of the cave. We're actually in the sunlight. So it was a completely different idea. But for the ancients, Plato was the man. And Plato was the man for the early Christian patriarchs, people like Augustine.
Who's a really important character in this.
Thoroughgoing Platonist, but so were they all. But then in this period, in the 12th, 13th centuries, you have Aristotle really coming into his own, because Aristotle is a better... Aristotle and Plato are both Greek pagans, but Aristotle is really a better fit with Christianity as it develops, because Christianity, especially in its Roman version, becomes more and more optimistic. As I point out, it was really the Romans who invented Christmas. They liked the idea of celebration. They liked the idea of celebrating the incarnation, the birth of the God-man, God taking human flesh. The Greeks always had a little problem with this. Human flesh, not good, spirit good. And you have a different kind of thing going on in the West. And so they find that they like Aristotle. And
he gives us the merry part of Merry Christmas about that time.
Yes, and he also gives us a much more positive view of science and what can be done with science and what the human mind can do unaided by anything but itself. It doesn't need revelation, which is what the early Christians all thought. You can't really do anything without revelation. Can't do anything without God's grace. Well, that's not in Aristotle, and it's picked up by people like Bacon, but much more by people like Abelard and Thomas Aquinas, who say, no, the human mind is fine. There's nothing wrong with it. We get things wrong, but that's not because we're sitting in the darkness of the cave.
That's a huge shift.
We can build on this. And so with that, you get the impetus for science, because you get a spirit that can take up science seriously and say, no, we're going to look at this and we're going to figure it out. That's what we're going to do.
You talk about the great synthesis, or Chesterton quote him talking about the great synthesis, which is the coming together of Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas.
In
Aquinas's, basically his theology, part of what is interesting about the way you present that is that Aquinas, thinking great thoughts, many of which were construed as heretical, but his mode of presentation was such that he was able, within fairly short order, to ultimately triumph. Now, the first 50 years weren't so good, but after that.
But it doesn't have to be a nice, plump little friar who says everything in a kind of non-threatening way.
Well, his predecessor is really Abelard, and Abelard is has his dukes up, and Abelard was clever and good looking, and everybody was annoyed by him.
Bit too much.
Heretics should be a little quieter.
Yeah, and then he takes up with Eloise, and this becomes one of the great love stories of the 12th century, maybe the great love story of the 12th century.
Or maybe of all time.
And it's very, very sad the way it ends, and your listeners can read the book to find out what happens. Aquinas is a completely different type temperamentally. He's saying all the same things that Abelard was saying, but he says them in this humble way. Well, it seems to me, I think perhaps that, and everybody lets him, he gets a free ride. It's something that our presidential candidates probably could learn from it. The way you say something has a lot to do with the way it's received. And they people receive Aquinas then becomes or Thomistic philosophy. His philosophy becomes the basic philosophy of the Catholic Church, and in many ways of of the West, not just of the Catholic Church. I mean, it's still, you can find it all through Anglicanism, for instance. You know, it's hard to manage without Aquinas. Though Luther was an Augustinian, and Luther has in many ways more in common with Plato. There's more of a division between flesh and spirit. But once Aquinas is in there, he's never gone again. You know, he's never completely gone.
And we're still struggling with that battle between Plato and Aristotle,
yes,
between Thomas and Luther. And it manifests itself in lots of different ways. But this conflict between reality, experienced reality, and some human sense that reality is an illusion and that there is some greater spiritual place that is different from, distinct from, separate from what you and I typically experience.
And that only a few people can get to it.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
The exclusiveness of it doesn't work well for Christianity, which is a religion that says, no, everybody's included.
Which includes democracy as well, if you think
Finally.
About that, then coming into a political domain.
Sure.
We'll be back to do art in just a moment when we return with the Paula Gordon Show. Please do join us.